Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 69, The Council of Nicaea, Part 2. Last time, we covered the opening of the Council of Nicaea and the debate over Arius, which resulted in the famous Nicene Creed. Today, we conclude our account of the Great Synod by looking at the remaining issues the Council dealt with. The next major issue after Arius the Synod addressed was the date of Easter. Dispute over the date of Easter was nothing new. Way back during our coverage of the 2nd century, we discussed the Quartodeciman controversy. The Quartodeciman practice was the custom followed primarily by the churches in the province of Asia. They kept the great feast on the 14th of the Jewish month of Nisan, the day of the Lord's crucifixion, regardless of what day of the week it fell on. This was in contrast to the practice of most Christian communities, who celebrated Easter on the following Sunday. The issue came to a head when Bishop Victor of Rome excommunicated the Asians. This prompted numerous church councils to weigh in on the matter, and ultimately the intervention of the great church father, Irenaeus. In the centuries following, the Quartodeciman practice continued, but as a greatly reduced minority position. Complicating the Easter question was another factor, the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. More specifically, the relationship between Christian Easter and the Jewish Passover. Understanding this issue, however, requires some terminological clarification. See, this issue is often framed incorrectly because of the terms we use in English. If you were to go back in time and ask the bishops at Nicaea when Easter was to be celebrated, they'd have no idea what you were referring to. If you then asked them what the feast celebrating the Lord's resurrection was called, they would have replied, Passover, or, in Greek, Pascha. In most languages, the words for the Jewish and Christian feasts are the same. English is one of the few languages which has different words for the holy day, depending on the religion. In most languages, the words for the Jewish and Christian feasts are the same. English is one of the few languages which has different words for the holy day, depending on the religion. Since this podcast is primarily aimed at English speakers, I have not attempted to be clever and refer to Easter as Passover or Pascha. But to understand the issue the fathers at Nicaea were dealing with, we need to be aware of this point. Christians and Jews did not have two completely unrelated holy days with different names. Rather, both Christians and Jews across the Greek-speaking East celebrated the same biblical feast of Pascha. Where they differed, of course, was their understanding of the feast's meaning. For Jews, the holy day commemorated God's deliverance of their nation through his prophet Moses from slavery and bondage in Egypt, the Exodus. For the early Christians, however, the Israelite exodus from Egypt was only a type of the ultimate exodus of God's people from bondage to the devil, death, and sin under the new Moses and new Passover lamb, Jesus Christ. Many Christians by the early 4th century felt the church should not keep the Paschal feast with the Jews, that is, be dependent upon the Jewish community to determine the date of the feast. There were a variety of reasons for this. On an obvious level, the majority Gentile church found it strange that the New Covenant people of God needed to rely upon the calculation of those who rejected the Messiahship of Jesus. More serious, however, were issues Christians had with the Jewish methods of calculating Passover. With the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple in 70 AD, and especially after the Bar Kokhba War in 135, the Jewish world became highly decentralized. With the loss of the Holy Land as a center point of authority, Jewish leaders began to develop a variety of ways to calculate Passover. In one of our first 3 centuries episodes, we discussed early rabbinic Judaism. We noted then that religious calendar issues were a serious business between rabbis at the time. Determining the date of Passover was among the most important and contentious. By the 3rd century, though, the rabbis had fixed a new calculation method for their community. The rabbinic method was viewed as problematic, however, by many Christians. It was not used in Jesus' day, for one. Second was the issue of the vernal equinox. Christians considered it important that the feast take place after the equinox because they linked the time of Christ's passion with the 6 days of creation. However, every 3 years, the Jewish calculation resulted in Passover occurring before the equinox. Simply using the equinox in the Jewish calculation didn't work either, as it could result in the Passover occurring either twice in the same 12-month period, or conversely, not at all. The divide was further exasperated when, in the early 4th century, the Jews again altered their calculation to place the feast within March, which therefore meant most Passover dates occurred prior to the equinox. By the time of the Council of Nicaea, only a few isolated churches still kept the Paschal feast on the same date as the Jews. Most other churches followed the calculations developed in Rome and Alexandria, most notably that of the Alexandrian scholar Anatolius of Laodicea, who used a 19-year cycle to calculate the date of Easter. It was decided by the fathers at Nicaea that all churches throughout the world should celebrate Easter on the same Sunday, taking into account the new moon that follows the vernal equinox. Those remaining Christians who still followed the Jews were to abandon this practice and conform to the rest of the universal church. The Emperor Constantine was especially concerned with the Easter calculation and was quite pleased with the council's decision. In an imperial letter issued from the council, the emperor expressed how he found it utterly distasteful that some Christians would keep the greatest of holy feasts with the Jews. More importantly, though, it meant the Catholic Church was united in worshiping God on the holiest day of the year. Again, we see the emperor's concern for unified worship being offered to maintain the peace of God and therefore the security of the empire. Despite the council's decision, issues with the date of Easter would still persist. For one, many of those communities who adhered to the Jewish custom refused to comply, going so far as to even accuse the rest of the church of changing the calculation to please the emperor. These Christians were dubbed proto-Paschites by the wider church and were viewed as schismatics. As for the church itself, their own calculations weren't always perfect. The Nicene Council didn't lay down precise rules for the Paschal calculation. As such, there were years when the churches of Rome and Alexandria had different Easter dates, though over time the Alexandrian 19-year cycle would gain ascendancy. After the date of Easter, the third major item the council addressed was the Miletian Schism in Egypt. Though the great persecution was long over, and Peter of Alexandria had died a martyr, the rigorous Miletius of Lycopolis and his followers continued to persist in perpetuating their rival church in the land of the Nile. By the time of the Council of Nicaea, Miletius and his followers had grown to a hierarchy of some 35 bishops in all. With regards to Miletius himself, the council fathers were pretty firm. The bishop of Lycopolis would remain a bishop, but he was to stay within his diocese and was not permitted to ordain or promote any clergy. Miletius seems to have accepted these provisions, and he died a couple years after the council without raising any more disturbances. The bigger problem was not Miletius, but his clergy. Were they to be considered valid? In cities with Miletian bishops, there were now two bishops, a Catholic one and a Miletian one. Canonically, there could only be one bishop per city. The council decided that Miletian bishops would be received into the church, like other schismatics, by the laying on of hands. The Miletian bishops would then retain their office, but only as auxiliaries to the legitimate Catholic bishop of the city. Only the Catholic bishops would have the authority to ordain and promote clergy. If the Catholic bishop of the city died, the auxiliary Miletian bishop could only succeed them if they were chosen by the people and confirmed by the Metropolitan, the Bishop of Alexandria. The only exception to all this was Meletius himself, who was not allowed to succeed anyone. These provisions seem to have worked in paving the way toward ending the schism, at least for the time being. The Council of Nicaea briefly adjourned during the summer of 325. For July 25th of that year marked the beginning of the emperor's Vicennalia celebrations, the 20th anniversary of Constantine's accession to the purple. The Augustus invited the council members to attend a grand imperial banquet with him at Nextdoor Nicomedia. It was a lavish and spectacular affair, with bishops moving freely about the palace, passing through doorways protected by armed guardsmen without fear. The bishops were not just invited, but treated by the emperor as his honored guests, with some reclining with him or sitting on nearby couches. The event made such an impression on Eusebius of Caesarea that he compared it to the eschatological banquet in the Book of Revelation. The emperor conversed in Greek with the bishops around him, probably discussing, among other things, his vision of the cross, his dream, and the Labarum Standard. It was most likely on this occasion that Eusebius gained this information for his biography, which he claims he heard from the emperor himself. This also appears to be when Eusebius saw the Labarum as well, and discussed its origin with the emperor. It was also during the banquet that Constantine made one of his most famous and enigmatic statements. According to Eusebius, the emperor commented to the bishops near him, "You are bishops of those within the church, but I am perhaps a bishop appointed by God of those outside." What Constantine meant by this has been debated and discussed by historians for a long time, and it has sometimes been seen as key to understanding church-state relations in the Christian Empire. Eusebius interpreted the emperor's remark as conveying a sense of mission and divine duty. Just as bishops were charged with overseeing their flocks and guiding them towards godliness, so too was the emperor charged by God with overseeing the people of the empire and leading them toward righteousness. In other words, a Christian ruler had a duty from God to look after not just the physical well-being of his subjects, but also their spiritual well-being. Following the Vicennalia banquet, the bishops returned to Nicaea, and sessions continued down to the council's closing on August 25th. With the major issues of Arius, Easter, and the Meletians covered, we now move to the final part of the council's agenda, a variety of miscellaneous items. Though the major agenda items are often the things we think about when discussing councils of the early church, frequently these councils also addressed other, smaller matters, which were nevertheless still quite important for church life. Such issues were typically handled with canons, church laws, or rules. For the Council of Nicaea, the synod produced a total of 20 canons. Since these canons were issued in response to problems the church was dealing with at the time, they offer a snapshot into the daily life and practice of Christians. A little over half of these dealt with issues related to the clergy. The rest dealt with issues we've seen come up before, the lapsed, schismatics and heretics, as well as liturgical issues. The canons on the clergy can be roughly divided into three topics: ordination, clerical status and living, and finally, the church hierarchy and administration. With regards to ordination, Canon 1 stipulated that men who voluntarily castrated themselves were ineligible for clerical office. However, if they were mutilated against their will, such as by barbarian raiders or for medical reasons, they could still be presbyters and bishops. It may sound bizarre that the Council Fathers found it necessary to implement this rule, but think back to Origen of Alexandria, who castrated himself out of misplaced ascetical zeal, and then was later ordained a presbyter. Apparently, there were similarly minded men in the early 4th century. Canon II forbade neophytes to be ordained as presbyters and bishops. Naturally, the church didn't want brand new Christians being put into positions of ecclesiastical leadership. Better to have someone who's walked with Christ for some time wearing the cloth. Canon 9 admonished that before a man was ordained to holy orders, inquiry should be made into his moral character and history. Any cleric found to have committed grave and terrible sins, like murder or adultery, should be barred and/or removed from ecclesiastical office. Following on from this, Canon 10 absolutely forbade apostates to be clergy. If any cleric was discovered after their ordination to have once renounced the faith, they were to be removed from office immediately. Such were the canons relating to ordination. With regards to clerical life and status, Canon 3 took aim at the practice of celibate clergy who cohabited with women, usually a widow or consecrated virgin who was attached to their household, a not uncommon ascetical communal practice in those days. To ensure such men were above all suspicion, the council forbade this practice, stating such clerics could only have their mother, sister, aunt, or otherwise a woman whose relationship with them was above all question. On a related note, there is an anecdote that comes down to us that some of the more rigorous participants at the council wanted to impose celibacy on all male clergy, even presbyters. However, this was quickly shut down by the venerable confessor and renowned Egyptian ascetic Paphnutius, the Bishop of Thebes. Though an ascetic himself, Paphnutius reaffirmed the doctrine of the Apostle Paul that the marriage bed is undefiled. Only clergy who were celibate at the time of their ordination were to remain so, whereas married clergymen were not to be denied lawful physical relations with their wives, aside from times of spiritual preparation and fasting, of course. Continuing on, Canon 15 forbade clergy to translate or move to a different diocese. Wherever a man was ordained, that was where he was meant to remain. No ambitious bishops jumping from city to city to attain a more prestigious see. Though the intention of this canon may have been noble, it was not exactly a good way to harness the church's talent pool, so to speak. An exceptionally gifted administrator in a provincial town would probably better serve the church in a major metropolis. We'll see this canon crop up again and again throughout our narrative, often with it being completely disregarded or inconsistently enforced. Following on from this was Canon 16, which did not allow clergy who translated to another diocese to be received anywhere else. Finally, Canon 17 decreed that any cleric who committed usury was to be deposed. The leaders of the church should be upright and moral, but unfortunately, the practice of usury by corrupt clergy was still a problem, and the Council Fathers felt compelled to address it. The final batch of canons relating to the clergy, numbers 4 through 7, are perhaps the most interesting and important to our future narrative. These canons dealt with the church's hierarchy. Canon 4 laid down the ecclesiastical requirements for a valid ordination of a new bishop in a province. A new bishop must be ordained by at least 3 fellow bishops of the same province, and any remaining bishops had to give their written consent. Furthermore, all episcopal appointments required confirmation by the metropolitan, the bishop of the provincial capital. Canon 5 set down rules for regular church councils. All bishops of each province were to meet together in a synod chaired by the metropolitan twice a year, during Lent and during autumn. Such routine councils would ensure issues were addressed regularly. It was a good idea, but how often it was actually observed in each province left much to be desired. Canon 6 is perhaps the most famous of the Nicene canons. The canon was mainly concerned with addressing the authority of the Bishop of Alexandria. The ancient custom had been that the Coptic Pope was metropolitan for both Lower and Upper Egypt, as well as Libya. However, the reforms of Diocletian had complicated things. Egypt was now attached to the secular Diocese of the East, which was headquartered in Antioch. Furthermore, Libya currently consisted of two provinces, and Upper Egypt had been reorganized into the new province of the Thebaid. Since the church hierarchy generally followed the secular administration, where did this leave the Bishop of Alexandria? The Council Fathers decreed that the Bishop of Alexandria would retain his ancient rights as Metropolitan Primate over Egypt, the Thebaid, and the Libyan provinces. To back up their decision, they cited the examples of Rome and Antioch, whose bishops had similar extra-provincial authority. The precise extent of Rome and Antioch's diocese is not stated in the canon text. The reason being is that the bishops at the council already knew what these territories were, and so there was no need to explain them. This leaves us, though, in a bit of a difficult spot. Obscuring the matter further is the fact that future bishops of both Rome and Antioch used and even modified the text of this canon to make even greater territorial claims. From what we can gather, though, at the time of Nicaea, the following setup was in place. The Bishop of Rome was metropolitan for Suburbicarian Italy, Italy south of the Po Valley, as well as the islands of Sicily, Corsica, and Sardinia. Meanwhile, the Bishop of Antioch was metropolitan of all that had once been the old Severan-era province of Syria, which had been divided into smaller provinces by Diocletian. The canon concluded by reaffirming the principle that the consent of the Bishop of Alexandria was required for any man to be validly ordained a bishop in the Egyptian and Libyan provinces. What makes this canon so interesting is that it is an early stepping stone toward what will become the patriarchal pentarchy, the system of five ranking chief bishoprics, or patriarchates, under which all other metropolitans and dioceses will be subordinate to. These five patriarchs will be, in order of rank, the bishops of Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. We are still over a century away from the Pentarchy, of course. Constantinople hasn't even been opened yet as a city at this point in our narrative. And what about Jerusalem? Well, that takes us to Canon 7. Jerusalem, at this point in our story, is still technically the Greek metropolis of Aelia Capitolina. However, in our next episode, we shall see how Constantine begins work on transforming the holy city into a premier center of Christianity. Of course, long before Nicaea, the Church of Jerusalem was the mother church of all Christians, and its bishops were of the family of the Lord himself. As a result, there were those who felt the Bishop of Jerusalem should be the metropolitan for the province of Palestine. This, of course, ran directly counter to the status of the Bishop of Caesarea Maritima, the actual provincial capital. It didn't help matters that at the time of Nicaea, the two respective bishops were on opposite sides of the Arian controversy, Marcarius of Jerusalem and our church historian Eusebius. Unfortunately, the council's answer to this dispute was effectively a non-answer. They affirmed that the Bishop of Jerusalem had a special place of honor, but upheld the rights of the Metropolitan of Caesarea. So, yeah, Marcarius, Eusebius is still the actual Metropolitan, and so whoever succeeds you to the throne of St. James is going to have to be confirmed by Eusebius or his successor. By not firmly making a definitive decision, the Council of Nicaea allowed the tension between the two Palestinian sees to continue for over 100 years, until another ecumenical council finally made Jerusalem a patriarchate and put the matter to rest once and for all. We will see this conflict appear again in our narrative. That concludes all the canons relating to the clergy. The remaining canons can also be placed under three categories: the lapsed, schismatics, and heretics, and finally, a couple of liturgical issues which required addressing. The issue of how to readmit those who lapsed during persecution has come up again and again in our narrative. This issue was, as we've seen repeatedly, serious business, and the church was always forced to address it and reevaluate the best pastoral practice. The Nicene Council dealt with these issues in canons 11 through 14. Under canon 11, those who had recently apostatized during the persecution of Licinius, and who had done so without being subjected to threats or any harm, were prescribed a 12-year multi-state penance to reincorporate them back into communion. Canon 12 addressed how the preceding canon's penance applied to Christian soldiers who apostatized under Licinius. Licinius had, of course, reinstituted sacrifice and other pagan requirements in his army, causing Christian soldiers to be dishonorably discharged. However, some of these soldiers decided afterwards to rejoin the army, and therefore participated in sacrifice to the old gods. The council gave great leeway to the local bishop in determining how strictly these men were to be dealt with if they decided to return to the Christian fold. Canon 13 upheld the tradition that repentant lapsed on their deathbeds should receive communion, though if they recovered later, they would not be readily eligible for communion, but instead to be placed alongside the hearers, the penitents who were placed behind the catechumens. Finally, Canon 14 decreed that lapsed catechumens were also to be placed among the hearers for a period of 3 years. Such were the disciplinary canons. The next two canons dealt with receiving members of aberrant Christian sects. Canon 8 addressed how the church should receive clergy from the Novatians. Novatians, as you remember, were a schismatic group who took their name from the rigorous Novation of Rome, the mid-3rd century anti-pope who broke from the church over the issue of the lapsed following the Decian persecution. The Novatian Church had continued to spread in the decades prior to Nicaea. Novatianist clergy coming into the church were required by Canon 8 to submit in writing their willingness to be in communion with twice married Christians and repentant lapsed. Some cities or towns had no regular Catholic clergy, but only former Novatians. In these cases, the former schismatics were recognized as the official bishops or presbyters of their respective settlement. If there were both Catholic and formerly Novatianist clerics in the same city, however, the rule of one bishop still applied, and so any returning Novatianist bishops would be granted the rank of presbyter or auxiliary bishop, unless the legitimate Catholic bishop decided otherwise. There is an interesting anecdote about the Novatians at the Council of Nicaea that has come down to us. A certain Novatian bishop named Acesius was present during at least some of the sessions. The emperor interviewed this man, asking what he thought of the council's work. Acesius expressed his agreement with the Nicene Creed. The emperor then further inquired if the Novatians agreed with the church theologically. Why did they still persist in schism? Acesius relayed to the Augustus the events which followed the Decian persecution and the puritanical position of the Novatian Church. After hearing this, Constantine responded by saying, "Acesius, grab a ladder and climb to heaven alone." A clear demonstration of the inclusivist vision of Christianity espoused by Constantine versus the exclusivist vision of rigorous like the Novatians. Canon 19 laid down how the Paulinists should be received, the followers of the heretical 3rd century bishop of Antioch, Paul of Samosata. Unlike the schismatic but otherwise orthodox Novatians, the Paulinists were to be rebaptized. Their clergy were to be received initially as laymen, and only if their character was found to be blameless could they subsequently be officially ordained. If, however, later inquiry showed them unacceptable, the former Paulinus were to be deposed. The last two Nicene canons addressed liturgical regulations. Canon 18 was issued to address a liturgical problem related to deacons. Apparently, in some churches, deacons were distributing communion to the presbyters and were receiving the Eucharist themselves before even the bishop. This clearly could not stand, as the bishop was the successor to the apostles. It was he and his delegated presbyters who officiated the sacrament. As such, it was not right for deacons to receive communion first or distribute communion to their superiors. They should receive communion from the bishop and his presbyters and partake of it after the higher-ranking clergy. The 20th and final canon of the Council of Nicaea dealt with kneeling versus standing during prayer. The ancient custom was that on Sundays and during the time between Easter and Pentecost, Christians must stand during prayer. Apparently, though, some churches at the time of the council were not following this rule and instead were kneeling. Desiring all churches to be united in their worship of God, the Council Fathers reaffirmed the ancient practice. The work of the Council of Nicaea was now concluded. The final ceremony took place on August 25, 325. The emperor gave the bishops a farewell address, exhorting them to be harmonious and patient with one another, and asking that they continue to offer prayers to God on his behalf. With that, the council closed, and its members began their journeys back home. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to rate and review the show on whatever podcast platform you use. Be sure to visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and don't forget to visit the blog site at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.